Let's turn to John chapter 18. We'll be talking about the trials now. We're starting out talking about the crucifixion. We started last week with 18, and we were talking about the arrest of Jesus last week. And remember, as we talk about the crucifixion, we have to remember that each of the authors of the Gospels had a major point that he wanted to make about Jesus, and he chose those events during the crucifixion that would best serve to point out the things that he was trying to say. Now, John, you'll remember, had four major points that he wants to point out about the crucifixion. And the first one is the voluntary nature of Jesus' suffering. It was absolutely, completely voluntary. And we looked at this last week in the arrest, as we see in 18:4. It says, "So Jesus, knowing all the things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to them, 'Who do you seek?'" So he went out to them. They didn't have to come and arrest him. And then he's going to talk about the fulfillment of divine plan in Jesus' suffering, the fulfillment of Scripture in Jesus' suffering, and the majesty and dignity that Jesus had in his suffering. He retains his dignity throughout this entire event. And that would be pretty tough to do, especially if you were the creator of the universe and people were treating you like that. But he maintains his dignity. He doesn't lose his cool, in other words. He is in complete control of all that happens. Remember that he struck down the Roman soldiers in verse 6. It says, "So when he said to them, 'I am he,' they drew back and fell to the ground." He's in complete control. All he has to do is say two words, "I am." Of course, the word "he" is in italics. It isn't in the Greek text. All he said is, "I am." And they fell to the ground. So the point being here, the point John is making, that anybody that can do this doesn't have to be crucified. I mean, he has a choice. If he could knock down 600 armed Roman soldiers with just two words, then he doesn't have to be crucified. In verse 4, we just read that he knew everything that was going to happen. John is the only one who mentions that in his account. So we're going to have to skip back and forth to get the full account of the crucifixion, because as I said, each of the authors chose those things that suited what he was emphasizing. He went outside the city, remember, to make it easy for them to arrest. He went to a place that Judas knew he frequently went to make it easy for them to arrest him. Complete control. John doesn't record the kiss of betrayal of Judas. The other Gospels do. They report that Judas came forth and kissed him. John doesn't report that. He doesn't put that in here. Why not? Well, his emphasis is down in verse 8. It says, "Jesus answered, 'I told you that I am he.'" In other words, he didn't need to be betrayed, actually, although he was. He didn't even have to be, because he told them, "Hey, I'm the one you're looking for." So the words "went forth" indicate it was active obedience. He did not skulk around. They didn't have to come and catch him. He rejected any form of assistance. In verse 10, it says, "Simon Peter then, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear. And the slave's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, 'Put the sword in the sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?'" So he's not resisting in any matter, and he is not accepting any form of assistance from any way. He's in complete control. Notice, too, that Peter is never arrested for hacking off the guy's ear. In fact, Jesus tells them who they can arrest He says, you came for me, let these other guys go. And so they do. He's in complete control. Now we come to his trials. He's arrested now. Now he's going to have some trials. In fact, he'll have 6 different trials. And just by way of introduction, we should note that the proceedings in these trials will be somewhat different than we see in our courts today. Now, we think of evidence when we think about trials. You know, you watch Law and Order. You know how trials work. Or is it just me? Now, we think about evidence. You know, we think about fairness, even-handedness. Well, we used to, anyway, with a trial. But that's not what we're going to see here. None of this is going to be present in the trials of Jesus. There will be no justice. There will be no fairness, no even-handedness. It's going to be completely just an excuse to kill him. So the trials of Jesus are totally illegal. And we'll point out some of the facts as we go along that were illegal about the trials under Jewish law and under Roman law. The 4 major violations of justice, and we'll look at these in detail as we get to the verses, were first, the sentence was predetermined. It was determined before the trials even began. Look at verse 14 of chapter 18. It says, now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. And that was before the trials ever started. So the outcome was predetermined. The trials were merely a means to an end. According to law, Jewish law, a prisoner could not be sentenced the same day as his trial. That was against the law, and yet they did that. That might be one of the reasons that they brought him before Annas before they brought him before Caiaphas. So they could say, well, we did have 2 separate proceedings. So it kind of, you know, could get around that law. But the law said that you couldn't sentence him on the same day as the trial, which, of course, they did. The initial charge was changed in the middle of the trial. Now, think about that. They charged him with blasphemy, the Jews. So they all found him guilty of blasphemy. They took him to the Romans. The Romans said, I don't care about blasphemy. What are you talking about blasphemy? So they changed the charge so that the Romans would want to kill him too. They changed it to sedition or claimed he was a revolutionary. Now, that's not something you can do in a trial. You can't just change the charges around to suit your own purpose as you go. And yet they did that. The charge was supported by false witnesses. In Jewish law, a capital offense had to be witnessed by 2 people, and these 2 people had to be in agreement. So there had to be at least 2 people, 2 witnesses in agreement. Look at Mark 14. And again, remember, we have to kind of shuffle around because not every account is the same. Different authors chose different things to include. And in Mark chapter 14, and verse 57, it says, some stood up and began to give false testimony against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands. And not even in this respect was their testimony consistent. So they couldn't agree on exactly what he said or what he did. And that's definitely against Jewish law. And here's the kicker. Here's the biggest violation of law that really caught my attention as I was going through this. And that is, the sentence was based on a verdict of innocent. Now imagine that. Imagine yourself on trial. The jury comes in and they say, yes, Your Honor, we find this man innocent. And he says, okay, go out and crucify him. That doesn't make sense, but that's exactly what we're going to see Pilate do. He's going to say, there's no guilt in this man, but you can have him to crucify him if you want. So the sentence was based on a verdict of innocent. Amazing. Now, just a note on the legal system that Jesus was under at this time. He faced a Jewish court and a Roman court, as I've noted. And the reason for that was that Judea was part of a Roman province called Syria. So it was administered by a Roman official. He was the official top guy in this province. He resided in Caesarea. It was a seaport town about 50 miles from Jerusalem. You might remember when we studied the book of Acts, when Paul caused the riot in the temple and the Romans had to come in and keep him from being killed. The Roman leader there snuck him away to Caesarea in the middle of the night because they found out there was a plot to kill him. And that's where the governor, you might say, or the head of the Roman province lived. But he also maintained a palace in Jerusalem, and he was apparently there for the trials, and that's because it was Passover, so he was there for the Passover. Now, Roman policy was to let conquered nations have a token self-government, just to make them feel a little better, you know, and not quite so downtrodden. It was their policy to let conquered nations to have a little government of their own. It'd kind of like be a student government in a school, you know. They don't really have much authority, but they get together and pretend like they do. And they were very tolerant in matters of religion. And that's why the Jewish high court could even convene, because they were tolerant towards that. Okay, you have your high court and convene, but if a Jewish court ruled guilty in a capital offense case, it had to be retried before the Roman governor. They could not execute a person. They couldn't carry out a death sentence unless the trial was retried before the Romans. They wouldn't go that far. They wouldn't give them that much authority. So that's why we're going to find Jesus shuffled back and forth between the Romans and the Jews, because there are two different authorities that are in play here. Jesus actually had six trials. There are three religious Jewish trials and three civil or Roman trials. And they go like this. First, Annas. That's what we'll look at tonight. That's the first religious trial in John 18, 12 through 14. And the decision of this trial is going to be, go ahead with the murder, actually, but go ahead with what you're planning. Annas is going to give the okay, in other words, to what they're doing. And then they're going to send him to Caiaphas. Caiaphas is the high priest, remember. And that'll be the second religious trial, and that's in Matthew 26, verse 57 to 68. And the decision there is going to be the death sentence for a charge of blasphemy. So Caiaphas is going to say death sentence because of blasphemy. And then they'll take him before the Sanhedrin. Now, that what the Sanhedrin does then, and that's in Matthew 27, 1 through 2, and it's also in Luke 22, 63 to 71. The decision there is they're going to make the death sentence that Caiaphas pronounced legal, because they're the ruling body of the Jews, or the governing body of the Jews. So they're going to say, yes, Caiaphas is right. And so they get the Jewish okay to kill Jesus. Now from there, they take him to Pilate. And that's the first civil trial. That's in John 18, 28 to 38. And the decision at that one is going to be not guilty. The second civil trial is before Herod, Luke 23, 6 through 12. And the decision there is going to be not guilty. And then the third civil trial is going to be Pilate again. And we find this in John 18, 39 through 19, 6. And the decision there in this last civil trial is going to be not guilty, but crucify him anyway. Okay, so those are the six trials. And again, they're not all recorded in all of the Gospels. So we have to go back and forth a little bit to get the whole sequence. Now note that these six trials were all carried out in one night. So there's a lot going on here. About 8 hours worth. We get six trials in 8 hours. They had a swift justice system. Or non-justice system, I guess we'd call it. Because there's no justice involved whatsoever. So let's look at the trial before Annas. That's where we'll start. And that's in John 18, in verses 12 through 24. Let's read those. Starting at verse 12, it says, "So the Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. But Peter was standing at the door outside. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. Then the slave girl who kept the door said to Peter, 'You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you?' He said, 'I am not.' Now the slaves and the officers were standing there, having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold, and they were warming themselves. And Peter was also with them, standing and warming himself. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus answered him, 'I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple, where all the Jews came together. And I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said.' When he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, 'Is this the way you answer the high priest?' Jesus answered him, 'If I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me?' So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest." Looking at the details, when they arrive at the residence of Annas, it's kind of interesting to note that the list of the arresting officers here is very specific and very emphatic. In fact, each noun in verse 12 has its own definite article. So it's saying, so the Roman cohort, the commander, the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. It's being very specific and it's being emphatic because John is pointing out the irony of the situation. Here are all of these impressive officials with impressive titles, and they've come to arrest Jesus, and he stepped out and said, "Here I am, you know. Take me." So, again, he was in complete control. Now, in verse 12, Jesus is bound at this point. Now, it's interesting. This is the first time in the ministry of Jesus that he was not allowed to move around freely. This is the first time now that he is bound. Now, this detail is left out of the Synoptic Gospels. Only John has it. And then all the disciples desert him and run away, as he said they would, remember. Look at Mark 14. That isn't recorded in John, but in Mark 14 we have it in verse 50. Very simple explanation. It says they all left him and fled. In verse 49 it says, "Every day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me, but this has taken place to fulfill the scriptures. And they all left him and fled." So all of the disciples then bailed out. Jesus then goes to Annas, and it says, led him to Annas first. The word used for lead here is interesting. It's the word ago. And ago is a word that simply means to lead. So don't get the wrong impression. Don't get the impression that they drug him or that they forced him. They just led him there, and he followed along willingly. In other words, he retains his dignity. He's still walking, and he follows them. And it's interesting because this is the same word that's used to translate Isaiah 53:7 in the Septuagint. Look at Isaiah 53. Remember, the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. And in Isaiah 53 and in verse 7, it says, "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth, like a lamb that is led to slaughter." And that's the same word. And that's, of course, what Isaiah is talking about. He's retaining his dignity. He doesn't cry or whimper. He just lets them lead him to Annas. Now, only John's gospel records this event. He was apparently in a position to see something that the others didn't. Now, verse 14, it says, well, 13, let's finish that one. It said, "And led him to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year." Now, Caiaphas was the one who advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. So John puts this verse in here just so that we know for absolutely sure that it had already been determined that Jesus was to die. They already knew the sentence. The official proceedings, in other words, were just show. It was just a means to an end. Annas, just a couple words about these two guys, Annas and Caiaphas. Annas was the unofficial ecclesiastical or religious leader of the Jews, of Israel. Unofficially, he was the top dog. Now, he had been high priest 20 years ago, and they still call him high priest here when the guy strikes Jesus and said, "Is that how you answer a high priest?" Because high priest was a lifetime thing. You didn't become a high priest for a year and then you weren't anymore. It was a lifetime thing. And according to history, he was one of the most brilliant high priests that ever lived, and also one of the most satanic high priests that ever lived. He was a bad guy, and he was probably behind this whole plot to begin with. Now, Caiaphas was his son-in-law. He was the high priest that the Roman government recognized. So we have a high priest, Caiaphas, that was recognized by the Roman government, but his father-in-law was the real power behind the Jewish system. He was the real power behind the throne, so to speak, Annas. Question then, why did they bring him to Annas instead of the official high priest? There are several reasons we can give about that. First, because of his position of control. He was unofficially, he was the top dog in Israel. And it would take some time to call a meeting of the Sanhedrin to get the whole thing together. And because he was an expert in official procedures. In other words, he knew the ropes. He knew how to get things done. And he's going to get things done, as we will see. He's going to take things to the next level, so to speak. And if they could get his opinion to say, yes, go ahead and kill this guy, then that would offset any objections that they had in the Sanhedrin, because they weren't willing to go against Annas. He was the top guy. So we have him taken to Annas first. Now, in verse 15 through 18, we have a little interlude here talking about Peter and his first denial. Remember, Jesus told him, "You will deny me three times before the cock crows." And here we have the first one, and in 18:15 through 18, notice some things about Peter. He was not completely shaken by what happened in the garden. He still had his wits about him. He was not shaken by the running off of the disciples. I mean, he ran off, and then he came back to follow Jesus. And remember, he had sincerely promised to follow the Lord to the death back in John 13 and verse 37. John 13, 37 says, Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you right now? I will lay down my life for you. And he was absolutely sincere when he said that. And then Jesus answered, will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, a rooster will not crow until you deny me three times. And this is the first denial that we're looking at. But he didn't lose all his nerve. He wasn't completely shaken. In fact, if you want to call it the ear incident in the garden, when he pulled out his sword and whacked off the slave's ear, that proved that he was sincere. He knew what the... I mean, there were 600 armed Roman soldiers there. He knew he wasn't going to fight his way through those. So he was sincere. He still had the nerve to follow the Lord. And there was another disciple with him. And they followed, and Peter followed. Although he was afraid, he did it anyway. And that's what they say. Have you ever heard that? Real courage isn't not being afraid. Real courage is being afraid and going ahead and doing it anyway. That's what courage is. And that's what Peter had. I think Peter was a courageous man myself. Yeah, did he make a mistake? Sure. Did we make a mistake? Do we ever make mistakes? All the time. Look at Matthew 26. It's recorded back there that he was afraid. Matthew 26, 58. Peter's following Jesus and the group that arrested him. And it says, but Peter was following him at a distance. So he was holding back a little bit and following along at a distance. So he was a little afraid, and he was caught off guard by this slave girl. I mean, he never expected this little slave girl to say, hey, aren't you one of his followers? So he just kind of blurted out, I'm not. Sometimes Peter gets a bum rap. I think he was a courageous man myself. Now, who's the other disciple that went along? The text doesn't say, and there are a lot of opinions. And many, and I'll go along with this group, think it was John. And remember how John has a habit of referring to himself kind of around the corner like that? Look at John 21, for example. John 21 and verse 20. It says, Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. The one who also had leaned back on his bosom at the supper and said, Lord, who is the one who betrays you? So Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, Lord, and what about this man? Jesus said to him, if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. Therefore, this saying went out among the brethren that the disciple would not die. But Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but only, if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? This is the disciple who is testifying to these things and wrote these things. So see, he said, the disciple who did this, the disciple who did that, I'm the disciple. And he kind of refers to himself in a around the corner way, and he was often with Peter. Remember at the tomb they were together? And so I think John probably was the other disciple here. The argument against that is, what in would John have with the high priest? Because the other disciple is the one who gets Peter through the door. Remember when we just read it? So we're not told that, but I assume he had some in or another, because he was allowed to bring Peter in with him. Now, in Annas's court, Jesus gets questioned. And again, look at the illegality of this event. First of all, proceedings at night were strictly prohibited. You couldn't have a trial at night. And remember back in 18:3, it says that the priests and Pharisees came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. It's in the middle of the night. And they're having a proceeding. That's illegal. Private preliminary examinations were also illegal. I mean, you couldn't go get things set up with the high priest before you went to trial. You had to display your evidence at the trial. And the witness could not be made to incriminate himself. They had a presumption of innocence, just like we do. And they had they probably didn't call it the Fifth Amendment, but they had a law against self-incrimination. Well, look at verse 19, where it says, "The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching." He shouldn't be made to incriminate himself. It was not the responsibility of Jesus, in other words, to prove that he was innocent. They had to prove that he was guilty. It went the other way. But that's not what's going on here. Annas says, "All right, you tell me about your teaching and prove that you're not a blasphemer." Well, Jesus didn't have to do that. That wasn't his place. They were to bring forth witnesses to prove that he was guilty. Another interesting point is a judge was not allowed to initiate charges. Only witnesses could do that. Look back at Mark 14 again, in verse 61. Who makes the charge? In 14:61 it says, "But he kept silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest was questioning him and saying to him, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?'" So he's the one that's making the charges, because that would be a charge of blasphemy. The indictment was supposed to be stated, and it wasn't in Annas' little mini-trial here, I guess you could call it. So in Jewish court, remember, the charge was blasphemy. We looked at in Mark 14. At the Roman court, it was changed to sedition. Look at John 19:12. In 19:12, they don't say anything about blasphemy. They say, as a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him because Pilate had found him not guilty. But the Jews cried out, saying, "If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar." So that's changing the charge. That wasn't the charge. The charge was blasphemy before. Now it's, well, he's trying to usurp Caesar's power. And so the charge has changed to sedition, or being a revolutionary. Now back at chapter 18 and verse 19, it says, "The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching." Notice the order of the questions. First, he questioned him about his disciples. How many people do you have behind you? In other words, before he asked him about his teaching, that was the main thing. He wanted to know how big this group was. That was his. And remember, Annas, he knew the ropes. He knew what was going on. And he wanted to make sure that Jesus didn't have enough followers to make it tough for him. So Jesus replies in verse 20 and 21. And we see three very emphatic pronouns in these verses. In verse 20, it says, "Jesus answered him, 'I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple, where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret.'" So three, and they're very emphatic in the Greek. And why did he do that? It seems here like he's being uncooperative, doesn't it? Because he goes on to say, "Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said." So it kind of seems like he's being uncooperative, but really he's not. What he's doing is he's pointing out something. He's making a point. And the point is that the high priest is not proceeding according to the law. He's not proceeding. It was the duty of the high priest to present witnesses. And in fact, the witnesses for the defense were supposed to be presented first. We don't even have any witnesses here at all. He had not taught in secret. He said, I taught where everybody could hear me. Go find some witnesses and do this like the law states you should. So he's just making a point that, Annas, you're not following the law at all. So the law had been set in motion because an arrest had been made. They arrested him. And now Annas is proceeding contrary to the Jewish law. So Jesus points that out. He said, hey, I spoke all over the place. I spoke in the temple. You know, I spoke all over. Go find some witnesses if you want to prove something. And that's what he's saying then. The correct way to proceed for Annas would be to call witnesses and let them tell their story. Now in verse 22, we have the reaction of the officer. It says, when he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, is this the way you answer the high priest? Well, the reaction of the officer is illegal, and Jesus points this out with a question. He says in verse 23, if I had spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong. See, again, he's saying you need to have witnesses. Testify. But if rightly, why do you strike me? Jesus points out even that things weren't done correctly. Now, Annas then sends him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. It's kind of an interesting note here, and we'll end on this interesting note, that one of the main themes throughout the whole book of John has been Jesus' witness that he was the Son of God. Hasn't it? He said over and over and over and over again. He proved it with miracles. Now, it's been one of the main themes. And now, he asks his enemies to present their witness. And what do? They don't have any. They don't care. They just want him dead. It's just that simple. So this ends his examination before Annas. Completely illegal, completely inadequate, and in verse 22, even brutal. It was against the law to strike someone before they were found guilty. So Annas sends him along to Caiaphas then. And we'll stop there tonight, as that's the end of Annas' little pre-trial interrogation. Father, thank you again for sending your son to go through all this suffering and misery and to eventually die on the cross to pay the penalty for our sins. It's in his name we pray. Amen.